Hey, Thomas. Today, Comrade Barney will be speaking to us on banking. So I'll just leave it to Comrade Barney.
Well, Comrades, for about 15, 20 years after I joined the party, I still knew little or nothing about how capitalism operates on the financial side. And you've got to remember that one of the most important pillars of the capitalist system, if not the most important pillar of it, is the financial side. And the party's always taken the view that knowledge is power. And I've always taken the view that members should try to extend their knowledge. So with that in mind, I started to read up on the financial services industry. I began to read about the City of London, about the stock exchange, about the banking system, and so on. And I've got to say, I was surprised that it wasn't the chore that I had expected it to be. In fact, it was very interesting, so interesting, in fact, that I'm still reading about it. Now, what I intend to do tonight is have a look at the four main types of banks. That is central banks, clearing banks, merchant banks, investment banks. Each has got a different purpose for existing, and each provides different services, although there is some overlapping. Now, you're not going to get a comprehensive explanation about the banking system from me. All you're going to get tonight is the tip of the iceberg. But nevertheless, it could be a start. Now, central banks, but what are they? I'll bet you the man and the woman in the street wouldn't have a clue about what a central bank is. And for all those years, I didn't either. Well, the central bank is the government's banker. And in Britain, it is, of course, the Bank of England. In America, it's the Federal Reserve. In Germany, the Bundesbank, and so on and so forth. So, what does the Bank of England do for the government? Well, it tries to assist it. Well, that's a theory anyway. It tries to assist it in any way it can. And there's several ways it can do this. One is to raise loans for the government. And this could take the form of either the sale of government bonds, which have got a fixed rate of interest and have got a fixed lifespan. And the lifespan can last for anywhere from 5 to about 30 years. These are long-term loans to the government. But there's also short-term loans. And these are made by buying things called treasury bills. Now, they're just short-term loans, as I say, and they've only got a lifespan of 3 months. Now, these things, bonds and treasury bills, are quite attractive to financial institutions because they can easily be turned into cash very quickly. So, that's one way that they can help the government. Now, other ways they can help is, the Bank of England regulates the amount of currency that is in circulation and also supervises the entire British banking system, including those foreign banks that are present over here. The idea is to make sure they don't do things that they shouldn't be doing and to keep them within the law and so forth. Now, the Bank of England has not always been successful in doing that. In fact, there's been some spectacular failures in the past, recent past. Some of you will perhaps remember that in the 1980s, there was a bank that gained great popularity with savers. It was the Bank of International Credit and Commerce. And the reason why it was popular with savers was because it was offering a rate of interest in your savings over and above the norm. It went bust and the savers lost everything. And more recently, there's been a similar happening where all those British savers, they withdrew their money from banks and building societies here and they put them into an Icelandic bank for the same reason, that it was offering a rate of interest that was very attractive. And like the BICC bank, the Icelandic bank went bust. And in this case, the British savers actually did get their money back. So that's what a central bank is. It's a government's banker in any particular country. Now, the second one I mentioned was the clearing banks. Now, what are they? Why are they called clearing banks? Simply because they clear one another's checks. I've got an account with the Clydesdale Bank, but the very few checks that I get are ones that are issued by other banks, but the Clydesdale accepts them and puts the money into my account. And that's what's happening with all the banks. They're all taking one another's checks, and at the end of each working day, believe it or not, there's a settling up to be done. The Clydesdale estimates how many checks of other banks has cashed, and vice versa. In fact, they're all doing that. There's a big reckoning to be done at the end to find out who owes what and who is owed what. So that's the role of the clearing banks, which incidentally are sometimes referred to as clearing as a retail banks. Now, it's just two different words to explain the same thing. Now, who are they? Well, there's the three main Scottish banks. There's the Royal Bank of Scotland, the Bank of Scotland and Clydesdale. But there's many English and foreign banks now operating in Scotland, where I live. There's a branch of the Santander branch, that's a Spanish bank. And there's also a branch of Lloyds. And I know the Scottish banks are also moving into the high streets in England. So there's a lot going on there. Now, these clearing banks, they're the only banks that you and I deal with. You and I don't deal with a central bank or a merchant bank or an investment bank. The clearing banks, our wages, our salaries, our pensions are paid into these clearing banks. And the issuers with a checkbook and a check card, they sell us mortgages, and they also lend us money, not so much just now because of the situation, but normally they'll lend us money to get a mortgage, they'll lend us money to buy a new car, extension to the house, a conservatory, or even a holiday. So they do all those things. But more importantly, from their point of view, is that, and the man in the street would be baffled by this one, is that banks lend to one another. Because, believe it or not, sometimes a bank will run short of readies and it will ask for a loan from some other clearing bank. It is actually a thing called LIBOR. It's an acronym. LIBOR, London Bank, London Interbank, London Interbank Offering Rate. That's what a bank will charge another bank for lending it money. But whether they're doing that just now, I very much doubt. Although banks get bailed out by the government, not just in this country, but elsewhere, once they got the money, they'll go into it. For the simple reason that they weren't very sure that they would ever get it back. So that's the clearing banks. Next up is the merchant banks. Now, why is a bank called a merchant bank? Well, you've possibly worked it out yourselves. They started off as merchants in the 18th and the early 19th centuries. They got involved in banking as a sideline, and it just so happens that the banking side was much more profitable, so the merchandising got dropped. So merchant banks are much smaller than, say, the clearing banks. They tend to have niche markets because they specialise in certain aspects of banking. They don't provide a comprehensive banking service. They specialise in certain areas of banking. For example, some of them will specialise in the takeovers. During the 1980s, if you remember, there was a big battle went on between Guinness and a Scottish whiskey distiller, Dewars. What happened was Guinness hired a merchant bank to mastermind its campaign, and Dewars hired another merchant bank to resist Guinness's unwelcome attentions. So other things merchant banks specialise in is raising loans for foreign governments and underwriting new shares and corporate bond issues and so on. But the most important thing, the one that was really came to the fore, the one that brought merchant banks into the public domain, where it wasn't a mystery anymore. We knew there was such a thing as called merchant banks. And that was during the Thatcher government period, when the Tories were privatising all the nationalised industries. They were privatising the public utilities like gas, electricity, water. They also nationalised industries such as the British Telecoms and British Airways and so on. Now, the Tories couldn't do that. They didn't have the expertise to do it. So what they did was they hired merchant banks to do it all for them. And in return, the merchant banks got a big, fat fee. Now, there used to be a lot more of these merchant banks, but what's happened is the numbers have been reduced because bigger banks have been buying some of them up. And not only that, the clearing banks have started to muscle in on the markets of the merchant banks by setting up their own merchant bank section within the clearing bank. So it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, as you know. Now, the last one is the investment banks. And these are the ones that have been hitting the headlines now ever since the start of the slump and the big banking crisis. There's lots of investment banks, but I'm going to deal with the biggest ones. The Wall Street giants like Goldman Sachs, Solomon Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers that went bankrupt, and one or two others. Now, what do investment banks do? Well, the answer to that one is they do just about absolutely everything you can think of. Is there anything to do with banking? I've got a book here, very useful, it's in the 6th edition, it's a bestseller. It's called The Money Machine, How the City Works. And one of the things it points out in here is that the biggest investment banks, like the ones I've been mentioning here, are all singing, all dancing institutions, which play almost every role in the financial system. And that's true. Except one, there is one area in which the investment banks don't operate, and that's as a clearing bank. They don't operate as retail bankers. That is, they can't take people in off the street to open an account, because they don't have a branch system to start with anyway. And they used to have the right to do that. They used to have the right to act also as clearing banks. But after the Wall Street crash, that right got taken away because it was so obvious that investment banks were using that depositors' money for purposes that had nothing to do with their savings. So that doesn't happen anymore. Investment banks cannot indulge in clearing banks activity or anything like that. Now, remember what I said about the merchant banks, all the different activities that they take part in. They do just about everything. Not each of them, but collectively, they do just about everything. And that's what the big investment banks are like. They are like all that the merchant banks combined, they don't have them in America, of course, but combined, but they do it as a single unit under one roof. So that's what the investment banks can do. Now, I'm just going to conclude now, Comrade Chairman, because we took a long time to discuss other things. The investment banks are great risk takers. And because of that, they lost incredible amounts of money during that bankers' crisis 2-3 years ago. And some of the biggest ones, one of them went under, that was Lehman Brothers, that bit of dust. Another couple would have gone under, but they were bailed out by the American government. And another couple were saved because they were bought over by other banks. So they've been getting the blame for the slump and the banking crisis. Well, it would have happened anyway. Whether or not the banks had failed in the way that they did, it wouldn't have made any difference. Sooner or later, the slump would have happened because it's part and parcel of the capitalist boom slump cycle. So investment banks can make huge profits whenever the times are good, whenever there's a boom conditions. But when the situation changes, when boom turns to bust, then what happens is they make fantastic losses. Now, what that has produced is an awful lot of talk that you'll get in the media, television, newspapers, etc., about the usual. Something must be done about this. We've got to curb the strength of the big banks to do just what they like. For example, when I joined the party in 1963, members told me that the amount of cash the banks had to keep in reserve, they couldn't either invest it or they couldn't lend it out, was 10%. Now, over the years, that's dwindled and dwindled and dwindled until today. Banks are only keeping in reserve about 1% of their cash. So they're never in a position to meet the kind of disaster that happened 2-3 years ago. Now, there's a lot of talk about it. What are they going to do? The banks themselves held two conferences in recent years called the BAL, Switzerland, the BAL International Accords. And during these, actually were meetings, actually during these meetings they came to certain agreements about what to do about reserves. And they said, oh yes, we'll have to have them, we'll have to increase them. But no sooner done that than they found ways to get around about it so that they could continue to spend as much of the money that they have and either invest in it or lend in it. Because if you've got, say, 10% reserves lying in a vault, it's not earning anything. That's no use to the bank. They don't want that. They want to be able to spend just about every cent they've got. So you can't leave it to the banks. Governments think they're going to have to step in and do something about it. Now, in this book again, and this fella comes away with some quite good points, in dealing with this business about what to do about the banks, he says, any new system to try to deal with some of these flaws. For example, it will probably encourage banks to put aside more capital in good times to deal with the inevitable bad times. It may also require banks to be more cautious about their trading activities. The result will be less profitable, but safer banks. Of course, in the long run, they will find some new road to ruin. They always have in the past. Those are words of wisdom. That guy knows what's going to happen. The banks already, in the form of having the spokespersons, politicians, bankers, academics, coming out and saying, oh, no. No more regulations. They're not the problem. They're getting rid of regulations. That's the solution. Let the banks go ahead and do whatever they like. And that will continue to be the aim of the banks, to do what they like, give as little in reserve as possible. So there you are, comers. That's a sort of thumbnail a sketch, as I see it, of the banking system.
Thank you, comrade. The meeting's now open, of course, for other members to ask questions and a general discussion as well. Questions first, please.
Don't make them too hard.
I'll give you a simple one, Victor. Who's the author of that book?
It's a guy called Philip Coggan.
The
book's called The Money Machine, How the City Works. It's in 6 editions. It's been a bestseller. It's well worth a look. There's some things in it that are wrong. I mean, the guy seems to have fallen for the social credit idea, you know, that banks can create credit out of thin air. And there's one or two things in it that we could possibly agree with, but there's quite a lot of things in it that, even if we couldn't agree with them, are at least instructive.
You see, the government seem to be contradictory here, don't they? On the one hand, say that banks will have to be more cautious and keep more in reserve. And at the same time, they say, because of rising unemployment and markets collapsing, what they should be doing is lending out more in order to help small firms. Usually say small firms, you know. But in other words, they're caught in this contradiction. On the one hand, they want banks to be solid and reliable, and at the same time, they want them to speculate, because how are you going to carry on capitalism unless you speculate? So, I mean, even the government themselves are contradicting each other. Not only the banks are contradicting one another. I mean, for instance, an awful lot of the newspapers say it's terrible that you can't get a mortgage. They should lend out more money. You know, I mean, when my kids were down south, way back in the 60s and that, what would happen is that not quite as long ago as that, but maybe the 70s or 80s, you could get 100% mortgage. I mean, my daughter, as you were saying, even married at the time, got 100% mortgage on my boyfriend. All the two of them were working. But I mean, that's just... But nowadays, they're looking for more and more of a deposit. And it's one of the difficulties of people trying to buy a house. Hence, the boom now in this, people buying houses to rent them out. One of my daughters has done that as well.
That's where Biden's going.
Would be capitalist.
The guy that wants to buy it wants to rent it out to students. So.
Aye.
Well, that contribution doesn't really require an answer. What Dick's been saying is utterly correct. But just one thing I want to point out. As recently as Monday, there was an item in BBC's text. Big 4 banks loaned the companies £57.4 billion in the third quarter of 2011. Now, that's for the third quarter of last year, of course. So in 3 months, the banks have loaned out over £57 billion. And in the previous 3 months, they loaned out $53 billion. So things are beginning to move again. But the question I've got to ask is, for how long? If you're to go by the headlines in the papers just now, this business about the euros, what do they call it? The euro area or something.
Eurozone.
The Eurozone. Well, nobody seems to know what's going to happen there. And they're all making dire predictions. So, okay, banks are beginning to lend again. Whether they're beginning to lend to individuals, whether they're beginning to lend to each other, I don't know. I'll have to try and find that out. But they have started to move. But you're right, Dick, of course. But Carlos is just one big long contradiction, for heaven's sake. How often have we tried to stress that to people?
I think the thing about the banking crisis is that it really is just a symptom of the general problems of the circulation of capital and commodities, because capitalist classes always get this angst-ridden state of mind where it wants to keep the capital circulating so it can keep accumulating, and that's just not possible. The same with labour power, they want everybody to be occupied, but then at the same time, when the boom comes back, where will you get the spare workers from?
A reserve army of capital.
But at the same time, kind of really, you know, it's anxious about the fact that that's potential wealth going to waste, and it's just, it's trying to do the impossible. They don't even understand their own system.
I've seen an interesting documentary in BBC Four about a year ago, I think. It was relating the 29 stock market crash to, you know, the much more recent one. It pointed out that financial institutions, American ones, are giving unsecured loans to people who are spent most of their life in trailer parks. They've never had a house of their own. They were giving them mortgages without any collateral, and you know, they were defaulting in these loans. And it was a similar situation actually to the shares bonanza back in, you know, the 20s. I mean, America was turned into a giant casino. People were buying shares, you know, wholesale. And what I didn't know though was that most of these shares people were buying were actually going to credit. It was estimated that about 75% of shares sold were actually sold in credit, you know. People just didn't have the readies. But that didn't matter to them because they believed they were going to make a killing, you know. Well, of course they didn't. And a lot of people were left with mountains of debt. And, you know, the banks stopped lending. They stopped lending to industry. Industries collapsed, you know. Unemployment started to spiral. So you can sort of see the parallel there of 1929. People were being owed money without sufficient collateral. Then it was for the purpose of buying shares. Much more recently, it was for the purpose of, you know, buying houses. But either way, people defaulted. I suppose it's an example of how capitalism can't really think in the long term. You know, it's always going to make these short-term killings. And, you know, it just makes the same mistake over and over and over again. It's a system that can't learn from history, you know, because its quest for profit is just so blind and irrational. I don't know if any other members seen that programme. It's really interesting, you know, very well researched.
Yeah. Well, you know, acronyms are all the rage nowadays. Words like NIMBYs, and so not in my backyard and so on. Well, in this book, this guy deals with ninjas. You know, like the
turtles.
Yeah. And that's an acronym for no income, no job, no assets. You see? And, there's plenty of that. You know, long before this crash happened, I was watching programmes on television where you had reporters pretending to be people looking for mortgages. And they seemed to have some sort of gizmo with them where they could actually record the sound and also photograph the salesperson on the other side of the table. And these undercover people, they were going to banks and building societies, and they were getting money, if they wanted it, thrown at them. The ratio at that time was you could only get a mortgage that would be 3 times your annual salary. So if you wanted If you went into a bank or a building society and asked for a mortgage, say you were in London where prices are sky high, and you asked for a mortgage for, say, £200,000, okay, what is your yearly salary? £35,000. Well, you're not going to get a mortgage if you go by that. But a salesperson just hands you a thing called a self-assessment form. Well, you know, the applicant fills in the details and he's told, he or she is told, you want a mortgage for 200,000? Say you earn 100,000. You know, and of course the person fills that in, gets the mortgage, and it's got absolutely no chance of making the payments. But of course, the people who are doing the selling, they're only interested in selling it in order to get the commission. So they're not going to look too very deeply into it. So that's what happens. That's what all those subprimes were all about. They're subprimes because either the credit rating was too low or they had a bad history of defaulting on their borrowings and they could never get a mortgage. But yeah, of course, they started to give them mortgages. And that was okay while the boom lasted. Most of the people that were getting these mortgages, these subprimes, they were keeping up the payments. But of course, once the boom went bust, then of course they couldn't do it and they would lose the property. They would be chopped out. So that's the way the system is. They kind of see, have a look at this. Now, some people say, well, surely, as John or Norrie mentioned, they're not being able to learn from experience. Supposing, for instance, a company says, right, the bubble's going to burst sometime. So what we'll do is we'll cut right back. We'll turn our assets into cash. So it will have something to see us through the troubled times. And that would be okay if the boom came to an end the day after yesterday. It would have been the right thing. But you don't know when the slump is going to come. It's impossible to tell. So if you take the course of action I've just described, then what's going to happen is you're going to be waiting for the bubble to burst next year. Doesn't happen. Okay, next year. Doesn't happen. And the boom could continue for 5, 10 years or something like that, and the company would have missed out on all those profits that it would the rivals and competitors are making. So what do you do in a situation like that? Well, you all know about Northern Rock, how it went belly up and had to be bailed out by the government. Now, their chief executive and other executives were called before the House of Commons Select Committee on Finance. And the chief executive was asked by one of the committee, is there anything you could have done to have avoided what happened to Northern Rock? And the guy said, no. Now, at the time, that was taken as an example of the arrogance of these people. You know, they can't possibly make a mistake. But the guy was telling it like it is. There was nothing they could do. Supposing he had said, right, what we're going to do is we're going to get out of the subprime market, we're going to become this responsible bank that the government wants us to be and so on. What is the shareholders going to be saying to that? What is the savers going to be saying to that? So they're compelled to do these things. Even those people who did know what was going to happen, and some of them did, some politicians, some academics, some bankers knew what was going to happen, but they can't stop it. You can't stop a runaway train with your bare fist.
What do you think that, in a government that knew that they were selling, I mean, that business model was so flawed from day one, and they must have known.
So why was there no responsibility taken for that?
By whom?
By the government. I mean, you know, okay, they bailed it out, so those people didn't actually lose their money. But that business model was so far. I mean, you can't have such cheap money and sell a product. And that's what they were doing. And yet the government did. I mean, what can we do to make them more responsible? It's still not happening. I mean, you know, nothing has actually changed.
No, it's still not happening.
No. And, so what should we be asking government to do?
Oh, nothing. Socialist parties are not in business to advise the reformist political parties how to run the capitalist system. What we want is an end to the capitalist system. We're not going to try and agitate to make it more humane, to give it a human face and so on and so forth. Capitalism is capitalism. It does the only thing it can do. It tries to increase its capital through surplus value. And nothing's going to change that. Governments can't do it. And why would governments do it anyway? Because they believe in it as well.
So what do you suggest now that people should be doing to
Well, what I think, what we in the Socialist Party suggest we should be doing is working to get rid of the capitalist system. To explain.
Obviously, but, yeah.
Well, that's the only solution. I mean, as I say, we're not going to try and solve the problems of capitalism for them. We couldn't do it even if we tried, because these problems are insoluble. So there's no point in us even trying it. But even if we could, we wouldn't. We want rid of the system. See, the rest of them are all wanting to get rid of the effects of capitalism. We want to get rid of the cause of the effects.
You see, what possible advice, you say, why does the government not do something? If, for instance, a couple of years before the slump took part, the government introduced legislation and said, right, banks have got to have so much money in reserve. You've got to have so much before mortgages and so on. What would happen is other banks or other countries in this case would make a mint. Well, they, on the other hand, would be losing out. On top of which, the populace would be saying, wait a minute, what you're doing is you're stopping the banks lending money. That means then that they can't open factories, there'll be more unemployment and so on. It's insoluble. I mean, no matter which way they do, if they were the cleverest men in the world and knew within, say, a year or so of it happening, they would still get a doing off the populace, off the stockholders, off everybody, because they say, no, what you should be doing is lending more money out than out and getting a boom. As a matter of fact, there's some politicians, including the Labour Party, who claim that's what we should be doing now. That what we want is more and more jobs. So what you want to do is create more and more credit. As a matter of fact, it seems that, in fact, that's what the government's doing. What they're talking about now is just print more money, which will lead to inflation, of course. But, I mean, it's still no solve the problem. No matter how you turn.
All countries are pointed to these things. I mean, where does it end? You know, where does that end? You can't keep printing money.
So no, exactly. No.
I mean, it's a ridiculous situation. I mean, the Americans bundled up toxic debt and sold it all around the world. And that's why the crunch happened. But it's, I mean, I don't think, do we just sit around and talk about it and say, well, that's what happens, but what can we do to change it? You're a group here. I mean, I was a member of the party for quite a number of years. What are you actually going to do to change it?
Well, the only thing a socialist can do is advocate a new social system. But there's no banks, there's no money, there's no private property. What you have is
a world without frontiers. I mean, the fact is that we have huge barriers.
We have what?
How would you break them down?
What was that you said?
We have huge barriers. I mean, we have huge frontiers. And I think many people actually agree with the socialist principle, but they can't see that it will ever happen. And, you know, for years, I mean...
Well, it won't unless people do something about it.
I know, but what is the SPTP doing about today?
Well, advocating socialism. What else can
I know,
we do?
But what else? Well,
nothing
but
else.
Oh, really? Yes. Nobody can do anything about the.
So you can just sit around, meet every month, and talk about, oh dear. And there's nothing.
Well, that's not true. I mean, tonight, our minutes mentioned members elsewhere are very active. Sometimes we are. But in this very hall every year, we have a May Day school. And, you know, every time the left wing or the other demonstrators, whatever their identity, every time we have a demonstration, we missed out this time. But normally, we are down there handing out our leaflets, handing out our literature, and so on. So, we're not miracle workers.
But it's education. I mean, what's the party thinking now? How to, because surely, at this point in time,
what do you think
this opportunity?
How do you think they should?
Well, I mean, you know, I agree with all principles, but how do you actually get that message across to people?
By making the party bigger, by joining it and more voices and in the queue.
But how did we get to know about it? I mean, we weren't born without any suckleness of our mother's milk and became socialists and all that. Because we applied ourselves and said, well, what's the cause of the problem? And as the solutions, like you're suggesting, what are you going to do about it? We've looked at the solutions, the Labour Party, the Communist Party, the social credit that he mentioned, you just issue more money and so on, you give more credit. We've looked at them all, and they've all failed. So we said, we've got to look for an alternative. And the only alternative that we can see, you may be wrong, but the only alternative we can see is a completely new society. And the only way to get that, governments are not going to get you, has been a majority democratically organising for it. It's a hard, hard job, obviously. But what else can you do?
Perseverance is the only thing that we can do. And we can't do the kind of things that other political parties claim they can do. It would be dishonest for us to do that, to claim that we could have some special knowledge that would allow us to either solve the problems of capitalism within the system or bring about socialism for people. That would be to completely misunderstand the concept of socialism. So, unfortunately, there is very little you can do other than continue, persevere, use every opportunity you've got to put the case against capitalism and for socialism. And that's just a long, often laborious, tedious task. But you just have to get on with it, because one thing's for sure, capitalism will just wander on the same as before. And like I've written down here, prudence, risk-taking and recklessness. Now, these are things that can only be decided quite often with hindsight. It's only by looking back that then judge that, oh, this or that action of an investment bank has turned out to be reckless. But while it was happening, as the Speaker pointed out, you'd be daft not to. Everybody piles into what seems to be a profitable market. And that's just how the system works. And the anarchy of capitalism can only really... the only thing you can do with it is abolish it. You can't tinker about with it and make it work better or give advice to governments or political parties as to how they could ameliorate the situation. It's a system that's quite rightly been said of it, that just cannot learn from history. And every time these crises come up, it comes as a surprise to nearly everybody because they don't understand that the system that they're living in. It's a surprise to trade unions that the bosses are making these cutbacks and making your life more miserable than they think it needs to be, or that it's unfair. All of these ideas are put across constantly, and constantly you hear politicians, apologists for capitalism, whether from the left or the right, saying that yes, some action needs to be taken to make sure that this can never happen again, and so on and so bloody on. I mean, it's just the same tired old ideas that have been recycled. And all we can do in response to that is continue to put our solution, our potential solution to this problem, to as many people as we can. And it's just a sad fact of life that there's no guarantees in life, but if you don't try, you'll definitely not get anywhere. So all we can do, I say, is just keep trying to get those views across to as many workers as we possibly can.
Unfortunately, resources and members, it's very small, but forces against us, it's greater. But they've got control of the press, control of media, they've got all the cash, they can turn all the time, they can turn people's mind like this. For instance, Arvis this day, and so-and-so royal getting wedded, and all religion and nationalism, all the things of the day that we have to sort of fight against. So we've got to take all that into consideration. That's a fact. We've got a vested interest in keeping the system going because of having a great life. It's against the majority of a crap life. Well, it's up to us having the crap life to say, like, this is the end of it. We're going to organise it, get in it, establish socialism.
By the way, what's your name?
I'm Carol.
Carol? About words of comfort for you. And that is that capitalism, like everything else in the universe, can't last forever. Everything is in the process of becoming something else. We've been through so many different types of society based on different modes of production. Chattel slavery, feudalism, capitalism. A superior social system comes along. Because, make no mistake, capitalism was a great step forward for mankind. Because what it did, okay, it created terrible things. It created, I don't need to go through the catalogue of it, but at least it solved the problem of production. That had always been the problem previously. Capitalism solved the problem of production. Now, it can't last forever. Every social system must be replaced by another. Of course, for our social system, the one that we propose, that depends on the outcome of the class struggle. I mean, if the working class just never ever learn, if they never take any action necessary, then of course capitalism will last for a long time in the future. But it depends on the outcome of the class struggle, and it will not last forever. Even if it's only through a natural disaster, the earth can hit by a comet or something like that, capitalism won't last forever.
Everything comes into being and everything goes out of being. It's a transitory system of society we're living
in. If you ask the question, what are the governments doing anyway? The governments are obviously doing their best to back up capitalism. When the bank crisis started, I know you appreciate that, but that's the same now that the Eurozone situation started up as well. They're desperate to keep the banking system going, the money system going and that. And the solutions are quite clear to everybody, that we have to work longer now, up to our 70, we have to take less in pensions and that. And this is all because of debt, which isn't necessarily your debt. It's government debt. They spend the money, they get into debt, and we have to accept less.
To get into debt, let's face it, when money was cheap, people could not wait to just, you know, bog themselves down with huger and huger.
Yes, well,
where does the education of people, I mean, how do you move it forward? I mean, I was doing the same thing, you know, when I was a student and so many years ago, talking to trade unions and hoping that people would understand that there was a way to change their life and to have a better life. It hasn't happened. Without talking, we're...
Well, surely you'd agree.
And people still aren't getting the message. Well, how the heck do you get it?
Well, surely we'd agree that we're the ones that are saying it.
When you see...
Well, another thing that happened over the last few decades in Europe was that wages have actually been stagnant, and people are persuaded, workers are persuaded by what they see around them in capitalism, that there's certain things that they need. Now, personally, a lot of these things I don't feel that I need, but a lot of workers, being absorbed in the ethos of capitalism, do think they need these things. And then some workers at the edges of poverty really do need more wages, but they couldn't get more wages. So what they did was, they did the only thing that they thought was open to them, and they ran up debts in their credit cards. Now, we might see the foolishness of this. We might have thought, well, there's maybe other things you could have done. It's not our business to try and teach people how to cope with capitalism. Unfortunately, the only thing you can really advise people on is get as much as you can get while you can. That's the nature of capitalism. Unfortunately, workers are not suitably placed to achieve that because we're the subject class. I mean, it's no accident that the so-called education system is divided into special schools for the capitalist class that teach them how to rule, and special schools for the likes of us that teaches. The main thing we're taught is how to obey, and it's a pure accident that we get anything that could properly be called an education, and it's usually been by some friendly people within the system telling us a bit of the truth, rather than the propaganda the capitalist class would like us to hear. Because let's make no mistake about it, the capitalist class have been taught from a very young age that to say anything, to do anything to preserve their wealth, that's their understanding of class consciousness. They don't need to know very much. They're in the dominant position and they will say anything, they will get their apologists to say anything, do anything to preserve their privileged position. That's the only thing they need to understand. It's not hard to understand. We have all this wealth. These people, albeit the people who create it for us, someday they might want to take that from us, and that's their, they'll say anything and do anything to avoid that, and we have to be just a little bit more intelligent about how we fight that system. We have to be just as ruthless as they are, because they are, make no mistake about it, they are the class enemy, and people in any government of capitalism will always tell us that the national interest has to be looked after, and we're all in the same boat. We've heard it all before, ad nauseam. I've been hearing it for the last 50 years. As a child, I thought it was stupid. It doesn't get any better hearing the same tired old apologies for the system being trotted out over and over again. So, sadly, it just comes down to perseverance. We have to recognise our class interest in it and do everything we can possibly think of to try to further that interest. And that's, sadly, there's no guarantees. That's all you can do.
Peter, can we get Vic to wind up
there?
Aye. Are
going to get that bus? Oh, no.
It's all been said.
Okay, then, comrades. We're agreed it all been said. I think we'll close the meeting now. Okay. I thank you for your attendance. And the next meeting will be in a month's time. Thank you.